Turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 32. So if you're, well, this is the first week of the series. So if you're new with us, good morning, glad you're here. We're doing a series throughout the summer we're calling Sunday School Stories. And we're just going back and revisiting stories that maybe we haven't heard since we were kids a long time ago. And here's the challenge. So this morning we're going to talk about Jacob wrestling with God. You heard that, you saw the slide and you heard the song. But that's a story that kind of is part of a bigger story. And that bigger story is about Jacob and his brother Esau. And that story is part of a bigger story, which is about Jacob as a patriarch. And that story is part of a bigger story about God and the Abrahamic covenant. And that story is part of the redemption of all things. And so every one of these stories, part of the challenge is like, where do I start telling you the story? We can't start at Adam and Eve every week and tell the story forward. So every week, we're just going to have to pick a spot to start this story in. So this morning, I want to pick, the story of Jacob takes up about 10 chapters. It starts somewhere around 27, and it goes up through like 35, 37, somewhere in there. So let's work through this together. So there was Abraham. Father Abraham had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. By the way, we should have flannel graph maybe next week or the week after to like create scenes on. We're working on that still. Just didn't get them together for today. So Abraham had a son. His son's name was Isaac. Good. And Isaac then, I was saying to somebody between services, Isaac is the patriarch that gets the least amount of attention. His story goes like, my dad tried to sacrifice me when I was little. And then we don't hear a lot more about Isaac. But that then Isaac has boys. And what's unique about the boys? They're twins. And what do we know about the twins? There's Jacob. It's so silly that this is what we know about them. Jacob was smooth-skinned, and his brother was red and hairy, all right? So, twins fought in the womb. They keep fighting their whole lives. They get to the point where they get this blessing from their father. Jacob tricks Esau. Remember, he puts on goat hair. He tricks the blind old man, which apparently means that not only was he red and hairy, but red and hairy with goat hair was the feeling of his skin. It wasn't like the smooth, supple hair that I have on my arms. It was like goat hair, all right? So tricks his brother Esau, gets the blessing from dad. Dad says, you're going to be blessed, you're going to be rich, you're going to be powerful, all these things. Says to Esau, the older brother, eh, you're going to be all right. And so Jacob, there's tension there, things are bad, so Jacob decides to flee. He leaves, and on his way out of the land, he stops at a place called Bethel, lays his head down to sleep for a night on a rock, and has a dream of a stairway ascending into heaven, and Led Zeppelin was there, and it was good, and he woke up. But as part of that dream, he was told by God, God reiterates the Abrahamic covenant and says to him, hey, I'm going to make you're going to be like your descendants are going to be like the sands on the seashore. I'm going to bless you. And so then he goes, and remember who he goes works for? He goes and works for Laban, who is his mother's brother. And when he meets Laban, he also meets Laban's two daughters, Rachel and Leah. And who does he really like? Rachel. And he gets stuck with Leah. So he gets to the night after the morning after the wedding, and he wakes up and goes, ah, because he realizes that the woman he had been that married to last night isn't the woman who he thought she was, which has all kinds of questions in my head that we're not going to go into today, right? How do you not figure this out at some point? Anyway, so then he goes back to his uncle, now father-in-law, who he just married his cousin, now wife, and says, I really wanted the other sister. And so Laban says, fine, like you can have her in a week. After a week, you can have her, and you just have to work for me for 7 more years. So then he gets his other cousin, and then father-in-law, uncle has him work for 7 years, all right? This isn't a strange story at all, right? To us. Like, it sounds so weird when you say it that way. And so he works for 7 more years. By the way, he's not only, the text is very clear, he not only marries Rachel and Leah, but he's also given, the girls are given their maidservants. So their dad gives them their maidservants, which comes into the story we're going to read a little bit later. So then after some time working for Laban, he decides he doesn't want to do that anymore. He doesn't trust his uncle Laban, and then decides he's going to move back home. So literally, I butchered this in the last service, but I'll get it right here. Jumps out of the frying pan into the fire. Is that right? Yes. And so understand, he's leaving his uncle Laban that has become a toxic situation. You can read about it later. And he's going back to see his long-lost brother, who last he knew had no love for him at all. All right, so appreciate the tension here. And so Jacob is re-entering the land, which is where we pick up the story in chapter 32. So I'm going to read all of chapter 32 to give us some context for wrestling with God. And then I'm going to actually even go into about halfway of 33. Nope, I'm going to do all of 33 also. Sorry, it's a lot of reading, but we just need to do it. Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is the camp of God." So he named that place Mahanaim. Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed them, "This is what you are to say to my lord Esau. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban, and I have remained there till now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. Now I am sending this message to my lord that I might find favor in your eyes." When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, "We went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." In great fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the other group that is left may escape. Then Jacob prayed, "O God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, Lord, you who said to me, 'Go back to your country and your relatives, and I will make you prosper,' I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. Save me, I pray, from the hand of my brother Esau, for I am afraid he will come and attack me, and also the mothers with their children. But you have said, 'I will surely make you prosper and will make your descendants like the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted.'" He spent the night there, and from what he had with him, he selected a gift for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their youngs, 40 cows, and I just missed something, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 female camels with their youngs, 40 cows and 10 bulls, and 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. He put them in the care of his servants, each herd by itself, and said to his servants, "Go ahead of me and keep some space between the herds." He instructed the one in the lead, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'Who do you belong to and where are you going and who owns all these animals in front of you?' then you are to say, 'They belong to your servant Jacob. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and he is coming behind us.'" He also instructed the second, the third, and all the others who followed the herds, "You are to say the same thing to Esau when you meet him, and be sure to say, 'Your brother Jacob is coming behind us,' for he thought, 'I will pacify him with these gifts I am sending on ahead. Later, when I see him, perhaps he will receive me.'" So Jacob's gifts went on ahead of him, but he himself spent the night in the camp. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. And the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. And therefore, to this day, the Israelites do not eat the tendon attached to the socket of the hip, because the socket of Jacob's hip was touched near the tendon. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided his children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground, and seven times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And then Esau looked up and saw the women and children, and, "Who are these with you?" And Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given his servant." And then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What is the meaning of all these flocks and herds?" "I meant to find favor in your eyes, my lord." But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob, "if you have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift for me For to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably, please accept this present that was brought to you, for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, let us be on our way, and I will accompany you. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender, and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my Lord go on ahead of his servant, while I move along slowly at the pace of the flocks and herds before me, and the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord in Seir. Esau said, let me leave some of my men with you. But why do that? Jacob asked. Just let me find favor in the eyes of my Lord. So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock, and that is why the place is called Succoth. So after Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely in the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within the side of the city. For 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the son of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. There he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. So here's the thing, is when we start to study a passage like this, the first thing I do is I read. And so I read this week, I started the whole Jacob story. Started back at chapter 27, and I read all the way through the story of Jacob and a little bit into Joseph. And I just sit there with my notepad and I make notes. Like, here's what I'm wondering. Here's something that I should investigate. So as we read all that, what questions might come up as we're reading that? What are some things that just seem obvious or don't make sense? What are some of the questions we should have about this passage? Yeah, did Jacob lie to Esau in the end? Absolutely, yes. He says to Jacob, Esau, like, yeah, I'm going to meet you up there. And then goes exactly the opposite way, right? So he's reconciled to his brother and immediately lies to him again. None of us have siblings at all like this. Anybody else? Yeah, about seeing God face to face, and I thought this whole thing happened in the dark. How do you know who you saw? Yeah, and who was that? Man, angel, God? That's a great question. Yes, he did. He sent his wife into, he's afraid that his brother's going to be in a murderous rage, so he sent his wife and kids on ahead. Oh, he's an awesome guy. Yeah. I think there is, but I think he even says something further. Doesn't he say, seeing the face of God is better than, verse 10, no, please, if I have found favor, I said this gift for to see your face. Oh, is like seeing the face of God. Yeah. So he compares Esau to God. Yes. He's clearly comparing the face of Esau to the face of God, who he just saw the night before. Yes, I just saw God. You look just like him. Summary of the sermon, God is red and hairy like a goat. All right? We're not going to put that in the podcast. All right? What else? Yeah, how does he know the guy is God? Because the text tells us man, and then I've seen the face of God. Good? Yeah, so he seems to be trying to remedy things with his brother and then just makes the decision to, yeah, why? Why does Jacob do a lot of things Jacob does? Why is he continually scheming? And Jacob's name means what? Deceiver. So he's got a reputation for this kind of thing. Yeah. But even after encountering God, he just kind of goes back to, he gets a new name and everything and goes back to his way. Yeah. How did he get married? What do you mean, how did he get married? Well, it appears from the text that his uncle is equally horrible, so birds of a feather. Like, they seem to get each other at some level, and it's just a game between the two of them who's going to get each other first. And Jacob, by leaving, basically wins the contest. You know, he blinks first and gets out of there. Otherwise, Laban's going to do the same thing to him. Yeah, so somebody in the first service asked this. Like, what is this magical power that apparently they used to have? Like, I'm going to bless this son, and I've got nothing left for you. Like, what? I was reading it this week, and I find that really strange. Like, if one son says, bless me, I'm like, yeah, bless you. I want to bless all my kids. Like, they, what is this thing? And what does it mean? Then he's wrestling with this guy all night long, and I must have a blessing from you. What does that mean? Yeah, it's a very different kind of thing. And maybe even something that we miss 4,000 years later. Like, that had some meaning to them. Yeah. All right. So I want to, before we dive in, and we're going to answer some of those questions, all right? Before we dive in, I want to give you just some history, all right, real quick. History of interpretation of this passage, different ways people have approached this. The one way is somebody asked in the first service, is this just a story that's trying to say that Jacob had an internal experience? That somehow this didn't, there wasn't really a night where Jacob and some dude wrestled all night long. That's another good question, like, how do you wrestle all night long? A wrestling match in high school wrestling, I think, is 3 periods of 2 minutes. How do they wrestle for, like, nonstop all night long? How, that doesn't make any sense. And so some people have said, oh, well, we just spiritualize it. This is a spiritual struggle that Jacob was having, and this is a way of expressing that in story form for us. That's one way. My favorite classic interpretation is this one, is that Jacob is somehow wrestling an angel. Nothing in the text tells us this. Where this comes from is rabbinic tradition. There is one rabbinic tradition that's my favorite, and it says that not only is Jacob wrestling an angel, but they know exactly which angel he's wrestling. That the angel that he's wrestling is Michael, the archangel. And the reason, none of you asked this, like, why did the wrestling match have to stop at the sun coming up? What about this guy that he was wrestling is like, up the sun comes up, I got to get to work. Like, I'm done. I'm going. Like, it's over. What about this? And so the rabbinic tradition says that this is Michael that he's wrestling. And the reason that Michael has to leave because the sun's coming up is that choir practice starts when the sun comes up. I'm not making this up. This is really what it says, that the choir practice for the angel choir started at sunrise, apparently, and the other angels had threatened Michael with incineration if he didn't get there. And so the reason that he has to stop the wrestling match is clearly because Michael doesn't want to be incinerated, and the other angels are angry. I didn't make that up. That's really there. And then there's a tradition that Jacob is fighting a night demon, that in some of the folklore stuff, that there's some idea that maybe this is not a friendly creature that he's fighting, and that he comes through victorious on the other side, and there's imagery to that, that he fights his night demons, he fights his own internal struggle, comes out victorious on the other side. And then, I didn't pick this up in the first service, but the song that Danny had us do, which I thought was really cool, by the way, like, it sounds like it's really old, except for the guitars and violins, all that, but, like, just the wording and all that, very strange. But if you paid attention to that song, the lyrics were about him wrestling with Jesus. Am I wrestling with the one who died for me? So when we're studying the Hebrew scriptures and we see these places where Adam and Eve walked in the garden with God, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are in a fire furnace, and then there's this fourth figure who's glowing in the furnace. These moments where there's other characters show up, people call the word for that is a theophany, an appearance of God in the Hebrew scriptures. And some people even further, a Christophany than is an appearance of Jesus, that would say that maybe who Jacob wrestled with was the second figure of the Godhead. He wrestled with Jesus before Jesus, all that. All right, so that's the history. That's how people have often taken this. So what we're going to do this morning is pretend this morning that this passage is like a huge ball of knots, right? Yesterday, I was apparently the last people to wind up the hose at our house were my children, and so it required us to unknot the hose and stretch it across the yard so I can do it the right way, because there is a right way to wind up a hose. Similar to the method Brian Goodman taught me years ago for winding up cords on stage. There is a right way, and if you don't know how to do it, don't touch the cords, all right? And so what you have to do is you have to start pulling at knots, right? And you just have to pull them out. And like, if you've got something that's a knotted mess, you just have to pull at the knots and pull at the threads and get it all out. So we're going to pull out a whole bunch of threads, and I'm going to go really fast because I only went 20 minutes over in the last service. So if you have to be somewhere, you will not offend me. I'm sorry. I just cannot edit. All right. I'll tell you, this is what this is what I love about my job, is passages like this. Somebody sent me a couple articles in preparation for this, and I just got totally geeked out on Tuesday, and like, the day flew by, and I was like, oh, I've just like found all this cool stuff, and I was so excited. And so you just are the captive audiences for what really gets me excited. So I'm sorry if this is way geeky, but it is who I am. All right, so let's pull at threads. If we're going to look at any good story, we got to look at names. All right, so let's look at some of the names real fast. Jabbok. Jabbok is a small tributary of the Jordan River. It's north of the Dead Sea on the east side. What's significant about the Jabbok, let's say two things that are significant about the Jabbok. One is it's a marshy area on the east, and it would be one of the first places that one might see the sunrise. If you're writing from the perspective of a Jew in Israel, it's one of the places that you would see the sunrise first. The sun is mentioned several times in this passage, and it's going to become important when we pull it another thread later. But the other thing about the Jabbok is the idea in Israel's history that crossing over water matters, right? So crossing through the Red Sea signified a change from we are slaves in Egypt to we are now free. Crossing over into the Jordan becomes a symbol of we were a nomadic people, now we've entered the land. So this idea, even like Jesus going into the water. So something about going into water, over water, around water, all those things have a lot of significance. And so even the idea that he's crossing over a river in the ancient mind starts like signaling like something big is going on. It's not just stepping over a creek. This is symbolic of something. And we see that then in the name change that we have with Jacob. And so the other thing that's a big deal is to get a new name. So we don't name our kids. Some of us have family names or names that have of significance to us. But mostly we name kids in our culture by like, I like the sound of that name. They name names based on characteristics. So Jacob's name, the deceiver. And part of this thing is he crosses over the river and then he receives a new name. That you're not going to be identified as Jacob, the one who deceives anymore, but you're going to become Jacob, the one who struggles with God out of this story. And that then becomes the name of Israel. We'll come to that later. The other name that we see come up in this passage is Peniel, where he says, I've seen the face of God. Some people think that in this passage, we find the second name of God given in scriptures. The first name of God is what that we can find in scriptures? We find the creator. We see Jesus in Genesis. Eventually, we're going to get to Yahweh. This is a name for God, Peniel. And so this might be a name for God. It might just be a description of what he had happened, but it's important because we see that then in the reconciliation with Jacob, with Esau. Echoes. So another thing that happens in Hebrew scriptures is this. If you're writing, one of the things that they try to do, so picture a really great speech at a wedding, right? You're the best man, you're the maid of honor, you have to give a speech. The best ones are, and we see this in speech all over, where people can take the introduction, and the introduction is good, and then when they come back around to the conclusion, and they tie their introduction in, and they tie it up in a nice pretty bow, and you're like, oh my gosh, that was genius, right? You've been at those places where somebody does a speech like that? So sometimes, if I've really crafted something, I start with an introduction. And then at the conclusion, I pull back to the, like, oh, this was the introduction. I tie it up with a neat bow, and I'm really impressed with myself. And you all maybe didn't even get it, but I like me. And so what happens in Hebrew scriptures is they write like this all the time. They write in such a way that you're supposed to go, oh, this is an echo of that. I'm supposed to be paying attention not only to this story, but that story as well. And one of those forms is called chiasm. So chiasm has a very specific structure. And chiasm says if there's a story, the introduction and the conclusion, they match each other. The second thing in the story and the second to last thing in the story, they're echoes of each other. The third event in the story and the third to last thing in the story, they echo each other. On down to where you find the most important detail, the thing that they're trying to emphasize, is usually the thing right in the middle. If you take the whole Jacob story and do this, the thing that lands in the middle is the birth of Joseph. Obviously a big story, right? Because the birth of Joseph is a big deal. This is how they're going to move into Egypt, and that's a big part of moving ahead into the next section of the text. This story, though, if you chart all this out, corresponds with another event. And I talked about it just a little bit ago. It corresponds to this event at Bethel. Turn back to chapter 28 in verse 10. So in this one, this is the one where Jacob now is leaving the land. What's happening at our story? He's doing what? He's coming back into the land. So Genesis 28, Bethel, he leaves. Genesis 32, Jabbok, he's coming back. And in both of them, in the night, in the one, he has a vision. In the other one, he has this either a vision or this wrestling or this struggle, whatever it is. So in verse 28, Jacob's dream at Bethel, verse 10, this is the one where he sees a stairway and all of that. Verse 13, there above it stood the Lord, and the Lord says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land in which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All the peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I've promised you. Where is this an echo of? Where have we heard these words before? Abraham. This is the Abrahamic covenant that God is saying to Jacob again, hey, I'm going to do what I promised your grandfather Abraham. This is still valid for you. Go down to the end of this passage then. What we see then is Jacob made a vow, verse 20, saying, if God will be with me and will watch over me in this journey I'm taking and give me food to eat and clothes to wear so that I return safely to my father's household, then the Lord will be my God. And this stone that I have set up as a pillar will be God's house. And all of that you give me, I will give you a tenth. So Jacob says, if God's going to like include me in the Abrahamic covenant, I'm going to be faithful to God. He's going to be the one that I follow. I'm going to give him a tenth. And then as we work through the Jacob story, we see no evidence that he does any of those things. If you read the narrative of him and Laban and Rachel and Leah and the sheep and the goats and the breeding of the animals and the stick that he cuts into pieces and puts up, none of that includes God. None of it includes giving God a tenth. None of it has anything to do with that. And so Jacob returns to the land. God has been faithful to his part of it. And yet the text doesn't give us any reason to think that Jacob has been faithful to his side of it. So we return to this place where he has a night vision and we see the echoes. Another echo that keeps coming up, as we see that the characters get fuzzy, all right? So Jacob is clear. Jacob is one character, but then God and Esau. We talked about the one. Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. Like, what? No, that doesn't make any sense if you've really encountered God, that you're comparing your brother to God. And so this struggle, and then we get the idea of the naming. You're named who you are because you've struggled with God and you've struggled with men. And you start wondering, if you read this narrative in its entirety, is Esau a stand-in for the God character? And is God a stand-in for Esau? And is the idea of them wrestling, of him wrestling with Esau, is it him wrestling with his demons? And the passage before, he's wrestling with Laban, and there's this fuzziness, and there's these little triggers that keep saying, like, this is supposed to be fuzzy. This is supposed to cause us to think Jacob is in this place where it's like this. We, 1 John, if we say that we love God and we do not love the people around us, then what? We're liars. It's the same thing here, that as Jacob is coming into this understanding of who he is, who God is, it's being played out in his relationship with Esau and his relationship with Laban. And I think we're supposed to pick up on some of those echoes. Let's keep moving. Numbers. If we see numbers in a passage, in a story, we should pay attention to those numbers. There's a number that comes up over and over in this passage. You know what it is? If you're thinking two, you're right on. 2, 20, 200. Look throughout the passage. So how many sheep, goats, all those? There's 200 of this, 20 of that. 200 of this, 20 of that. There's some of them that don't follow the pattern. I understand that. But most of them fall in twos, 20s, or the animals fall in 20s and 200s. How many camps does Jacob have now? Two. How many brothers are there? Two. How many people are wrestling? Two. It shows up over and over and over again. And I think we're supposed to be paying attention to that. In fact, let me point at this. I love this. Jacob says, verse 10, I am unworthy of all the kindness and faithfulness you have shown your servant. I had only my staff when I crossed this Jordan, but now I have become two camps. One of the threads that kind of runs through some of this, and some people have a little bit wondered, is that a statement of Jacob saying, not only have I physically become two camps, but I've become of two minds. There's the way of Jacob, there's the way that deceives, and the relationship I had with Laban, or there's the Jacob who's reconciled to his brother. There's leaning into the promise that God has given in the Abrahamic covenant. And you get this idea of wrestling through the night. How many of us have done this, right? You've been on the horns of a dilemma. You've had a thing in your life where you're trying to decide and you're of two minds. I'm of two camps. I'm back and I'm forth. And sometimes I think it's this way. And I think it's kind of this way. And I go back and forth. And maybe the numbers are triggering us to help us understand that Jacob is at this critical point in his journey where he's of two minds. He's back and forth. And everything kind of is, maybe that's a thread. That maybe he's at a place like this, a road diverged in a wood. I'm in a spot where I have to choose my pathway. Real quick, for those of you lovers of the Hebrew language, there's a wordplay happening throughout this story between these three words that kind of sound enough alike that you could play with the words. The word for gift is minha. The word for camp is mahneb. The word for favor is hen. And so throughout this passage, Jacob is sending minha to his brother so he can receive hen. And then he's of two maheb, like back and forth. These words keep getting thrown. If you look through the passage and you just start underlining or circling all the places those three words keep showing up, they keep showing up over and over again as a way to play with these words that Jacob has a gift to give. He's trying to give gifts so he get his brother's favor, which leads us into our next thing, that what Jacob is looking for is, I've offended my brother. I'm sending him gifts to pacify my brother. And what does he receive from Esau? I don't want your gifts. I want a relationship with my brother. We joke in our family that our two youngest are in love with each other. They're not touching each other right now, but they usually are. They're usually hugging and walking around each other, telling each other they love each other. At dinner, they call each other brother a lot and hug and all that stuff. And that's what you get here, is you get this picture that Jacob goes into this thing like calculating everything. If I send him this gift, this gift, this gift, and if you say the right thing, he might let me off on a technicality. And Esau's response is, brother, I haven't seen you in 20 years. Let's be reconciled. Don't insult me with trying to buy me off. Take your stupid gifts. Like, I don't need your gifts. And so especially those of us that are Protestants, we've been taught, especially in the Reformed tradition, we're taught that the Old Testament is law and the New Testament is grace. And yet we find episodes like this, maybe, if we pull at a thread in this story, that this isn't just about law and grace, but even in the law, we find these really beautiful, graceful moments where Esau is so graceful with Jacob, and then Jacob turns around and lies to him. That's the sun god Ra. So let me tease you with another thread. There is a story in Egyptian cosmology. Now remember that these scriptures don't really get put together until post-exile, right? They're not written down until after the people are out of Egypt. At the earliest, they're told, the oral tradition is strong as they're coming out of Egypt, it grows. They may have been written down shortly after Moses dies. They may not even be written down until much later, all right? So when we start talking about the Pentateuch, we have to understand that in the background, in their background, is a deep familiarity with Egyptian gods and goddesses. There's stories told about their understanding of Ra, that Ra is the sun god. That Ra rises in the morning as the sun god, and then Ra travels across the sky during the day. And as Ra travels across the sky, Ra changes names throughout the day. There's three distinct phases of the day in which Ra changes names. And so depending on the time of the day, changes the name by which you address Ra. And then Ra at night goes into the ground and fights his way into the underworld, fights his way through the demons and all the things in the underworld, and emerges victorious the next day to come up as Ra, the sun god, and to travel across the sky. Do you see all the echoes in this story? And it's intriguing. It's an intriguing thread to pull at, that what if what we have in this story is that the Hebrews, in trying to do their story, are taking the stories that they know, and then they're rewriting those stories to try to say something about who they are and who their God is. It's like us taking a song and then reworking that song with Christian lyrics, right? Which is usually a pretty bad idea in our context, but people do it. Or if you've ever seen a classic hymnal, we did a song, the Wesley song this morning. Oftentimes in really old hymnals, you have lyrics and then you have music. And they'll tell you in the lyrics, this song goes to the tune of, like, Danny and I were talking about between services. There's a tune called Nettleton. And I have a hymn book in my office where it has Nettleton. And then it has, it's Come Thou Fount of Every... There's like 8 or 10 songs that are written to that tune. And you just put the... And that's kind of what they're doing, is it appears that they're taking a story from Egyptian cosmology and then rewriting the characters and trying to say something about who Jacob is, who they are as a people, who God is, with using that in the background. There's a lot more to that. There's a lot more details to that, and I can hand you an article if you're really interested in that, but just an interesting thread to pull at. real quick, is this a man or an angel in the God or a God? There's really nothing in the text besides oral tradition that leads us to think this is an angel. The text identifies him as a man, and at some point Jacob believes that it's God. I think the text intends to be ambiguous at this point. It doesn't give us enough detail, personally, to say that it's one or the other. We've already talked about Israel, Peniel. I'm going to hurry. What is the deal about the broken hip? I don't know if any of you have ever broken a hip, but if you have, you can't walk. There's just no, like, there's no walking after a broken hip. If your hip's broke, you're not walking. And so even conservative scholars look at this kind of passage and this kind of thing and say, okay, so obviously the writers then are trying to use, there's a euphemism here at play. They're trying to tell us something that we don't understand that they would have all known. It's like when you call into your office at work, you don't call your boss and say, man, I had explosive diarrhea this morning, I'm staying home. Nobody, if you are the guy that does that, stop doing that to your boss. Nobody wants that, right? You call in and say, I'm feeling a little sick. I have the flu. I feel sick to my stomach. We say sick to our stomach. We don't mean that. But we're not going to say what we're really... Right? Nod with me, right? Please tell me that you use euphemisms for your own health, right? They do the same thing. They have euphemisms for their health that they say one thing and they actually mean another. There's two things that people kind of propose here. One is that maybe this is a wrestling injury. Maybe what the author's trying to tell us is that from the strain of wrestling all night, Jacob has some kind of a quad or a hamstring, whatever way those go. There's something wrong with his leg that causes him to limp, but it's not a broken hip socket where he wouldn't be able to walk. Maybe a more interesting thread is to go back to chapter 30, if you will, for just a second. This is fun reading for a minute. Actually, chapter 29, verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, he enabled her to conceive. But Rachel remained childless. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son, and she named him Reuben, for she said, now apparently this is what the name Reuben means. It is because the Lord has seen my misery, surely my husband will love me now. All right, which is too much to say, so she shortened it to Reuben. So when she calls for her son, basically in our vernacular, it'd be, come here, misery, maybe God loves me now. I love you, kid. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too. So she named him Simeon. So this one is called, I'm still not loved, I have another kid. Again, she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, now at last my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons. So he was named Levi. She conceived again, and apparently at this point she's given up on love from her husband. She says, this time I'll just praise the Lord. So she names him Judah. Then she stopped having children. When Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, she became jealous of her sister, so she said to Jacob, give me children or I'll die. Jacob became angry with her and said, am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children? Then she said, here's Bilhah, my servant. Sleep with her so she can bear children for you, for me, and I too can have a family through her. That just seems like the logical solution to all of this. So she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife, and Jacob slept with her, and she became pregnant, bore him a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me. He has listened to my plea and given me a son, and because of this, she named him Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again. I mean, and then verse 9, when Leah saw that she had stopped having children, she took her servant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. And Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son, and then Leah said, what good fortune. So she named him Gad. So now Jacob is working through four women to make lots of sons. And we presume daughters as well, obviously. So what some people think is if you tie verse 30 into it, go back further. God promises that he'll make his seed great. Jacob takes matters into his own hands, as it were. And that maybe this injury isn't so much the hip as it is more like this way. And maybe what is the euphemism is that God is working at Jacob's belief that Jacob is in control of his destiny. That Jacob, it's not you and your virility that's going to make your nation great, but it's me. I'm the one that's going to do the work here, not you. And so there's people that believe, and there's, well, listen to this. there's a story, again, out of Egyptian cosmology, all right? And it's called A Tale of Two Brothers, and this is not the craft beer. It relates to a conflict between an older brother called Anubis and a younger brother, Bata. At one point in the story, the older brother is pursuing the younger brother with the intent of seeking deadly revenge for an offense that the younger brother allegedly committed against his older brother. Does this sound familiar? As the younger brother is fleeing for fear of his life, he offers a sincere prayer that the deity would intervene. As a result of his prayer, the sun god Re, or Ra, places a body of water between the two brothers such that each is on opposite side. They don't say it here, but the body of water is also filled with crocodiles. Each spends the night on either side. The younger brother calls to the older brother, telling him that in the morning the sun god, when it rises, will judge between the two of them and vindicate him. Later in the story, in some versions then, he castrates himself to show his brother that he's no threat to his brother. Like, I'll castrate myself so that my seed will be no threat to your seed. Do you see all the parallels? Two brothers in a fight, separated by water. Something happens in the night. And then the idea of castration, some people have said that's what the Bible story is trying to do, is echo this story from Egypt. And so we get this potential thread. We're pulling it. So what does it all mean, right? So that's a lot of stuff, right? Egyptian mythology, Egyptian stories, different ideas, what the injury is, who he's wrestling, a lot of things to kind of like, so what does this have to do with us? What do we do with all this? So let me try to put some of this together. I don't know that there's some questions that we can answer. First of all, we're 4,000 years out from this story, right? And so maybe some of the details, some of like, oh, he broke his hip, maybe to the original audience, they all went, there's kids in the room, I get what you're saying, we get it. Maybe not. Maybe they were trying to say something entirely different. And in 4,000 years, we don't exactly know. It appears to me that it seems like there's something happening where whatever happened that night, whether it was actually Jacob wrestling with an angel man God, or Jacob had in his imagination some kind of thing, or some people have even proposed Jacob had some kind of a vision where this thing happens, but that whatever happens in it is that Jacob understands that this is a real struggle. That through the night, what happened? And what draws me to this story is this idea that not only is it a struggle, but it's a struggle that God seems to be inviting. That God, somebody in the first service really caught this and made a big point of this. And it's really good to say, it seems like in the end of this thing, that Jacob struggles with God and then out of it is blessed by God. That God values, wants, encourages the struggle. The best analogy I know is that, as you can suspect, in a house full of boys, we do a fair amount of wrestling in my home, right? And I could wrestle with my boys by pinning them every time. I'm capable, still, mostly. Even when they all four gang up on me, I can mostly get my way out, right? I could do it every single time. I could knock them all out every time if I really wanted. I'm that powerful, right? Instead, I lay on the floor and let them abuse me. And I fight back just enough to give them a challenge. And then sometimes I go too far and I have to apologize. But you know what I'm saying? I think at a bigger psychological level, like that's part of our job as parents, is sometimes to be the place where our kids can wrestle and we give enough pushback to make them strong and safe, in a safe place. When they start having questions about God, to be that place that they can push against what we believe and we can be strong enough to take it a little bit and push it back just a little bit. And in that way, we help them grow, right? The best plants are the ones that get a little bit of abuse from the wind. When you plant a garden and you grow stuff inside, you harden it by putting it outside for a little while before you put it in the ground because it needs some pushback from the sun and the wind. And so maybe in this story, what we're seeing, what I think we see is if God is wrestling with Jacob, that God is pushing back on Jacob just enough to form Jacob, to cause Jacob, as he comes to this point where there's two roads diverging and he just decide to be one or the other. Of course, what we see in all the patriarchs, and you're going to see this next week, not with just patriarchs, but with Samson, is these Bible characters are not so neat and tidy. They're so conflicted. And we see Jacob, even after getting a blessing and taking on a name, his first act is to lie to his brother and go back to his way as Jacob the deceiver. We see that right, you know, right? Like, we see that, but maybe this is what is in the character of God. Somebody sent me an article this week, and It's from Walter Brueggemann, and I'm going to quote a piece from the article in just a minute. But at the beginning, it had a quote from someone else, and he says, maybe the one thing that God is not capable of in the Hebrew Scriptures is monologue. That we don't find places, really, where God is just saying this is what it is, but instead we find God in dialogue with his people. That when God comes to Sodom and says, all right, well, Abraham, like, okay, if you can find 50 people, I won't destroy it. And Abraham goes like, ooh, how about 40? God says, fine, 40. And Abraham says, remember this? That God is in a dialogue? That Moses comes down from the mountain, God wants to destroy the people? Like, wait, remember, you love these people? Don't destroy them. And we see throughout the Hebrew Scriptures this dialogue between people and God. We live in a culture, I think, and especially in a Christian culture, that says good Christians shut up and sit in the pews and listen and get in line. And many of us have experience of being in churches where we feel like our voices were silenced. Like, I have this question, and I know that it's like, I know it's a little bit heretical in our church to ask this kind of question, but I'm just going to ask the question because we feel like we get beat down over those kinds of things. And yet what we find in the Hebrew Scriptures, in the stories, and in this story so well, and then especially when we get to the Psalms, is people who weren't afraid to say to God, like, this is the beef I have with you. Here's where I need you to show up. Let me read just a little bit. Psalm 35. If you want to turn, you can. I have it all marked up in mine because there's just such good stuff. So I'm just going to read you snippets as I work through the psalm. It starts like this. Contend, Lord, with those who have contended with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take up shield and armor. Arise and come to my aid. Say to me, I am your salvation. So in case you missed this, he's just give marching orders to God. God, this is how you should act in my life. See, we're taught sometimes in some of our traditions, and I think this is good. We're taught to fear God. We're taught to respect God, and those things are good. But somebody forgot to tell the psalmist a lot of that. I understand we need to be respectful. We need to be fearful in some ways, but the psalmist doesn't seem to think that way. Like, hey, this is what I think. This is what I think you ought to do, and so I'm going to tell you that you ought to do it. And sometimes when we read it so dispassionately, and I think it's full of passion. So keep going. Verse 9. After you do all this, then my soul will rejoice in the Lord and delight in his salvation. My whole being will explain, like, who is like you, Lord? Jump down to verse 17. But how long are you going to look on? Like, accusing God of checking out. Like, how long are you just going to let me drift in this? Rescue me from ravages, my precious life from these lions. I will give you thanks in the great assembly. Verse 22. Lord, you have seen this stuff. Do not be silent. I would say in the context of the song, stop being silent. Do not be far from me. Awake and rise to my defense. Contend for me. Vindicate me. Verse 28, it gets down to the end. And my tongue will proclaim your righteousness, your praises all day long. This is not the language of stop raising thorny questions. This is the language of people who understood what it means to struggle with God. And this has become the flavor of Judaism, and that's why we see them take the name of Israel. It's really beautiful. And why I wanted to do this passage is that we see the people of Israel take on that name, struggles with God, and it not only becomes their name, it's not just a name and name only, it actually is the character of who they are, and we see it all through the Hebrew Scriptures. So what does that mean for us? Brueggemann says this, my simple thesis is that the church, summoned, formed, and empowered by the God of all dialogue, has in our anxiety-driven society an opportunity to be deeply dialogical about the most important issues. Dialogical in a way that keeps our judgments penultimate before the holy throne of God. And I forgot to fix the typo. The idea, what Brueggemann is saying, is that if this is God in the Hebrew Scriptures, then what the church's job, what we're summoned, formed, and empowered by God to do, is to create spaces for dialogue. To create spaces where people are allowed to struggle in the same way that God is inviting each of us to struggle with him. About the most important issues. Fill in the blank, whatever issue you think is biggest in the church today, that I think the church is supposed to be the place where we invite and create a safe place for dialogue in the church about the biggest issues of our day. And people tell me that we can't do that. people tell me, and I'm not making this up, people tell me, Charlie, you have to choose. You have to say this or this. You have to come out and say, is it a sin or is it not a sin? Is this a thing or that a thing? What's your position, here or there? You have to pick one. You can't stay in the middle. And what I'm saying to you is I think that the nature of God and the role of the church is that we're supposed to be a place where we keep struggling with God. We keep going back to the text and asking, what does it mean? And does it really mean this? And we're supposed to keep contending with God. We're supposed to keep being Jacob. We're supposed to keep wrestling with God. Brian McLaren says it this way, and I just love this. He says, I think doubt and skepticism are part of life, especially for any person who has developed the skills and habits of critical thinking. So doubt and skepticism are necessarily a part of healthy and mature faith, not an alternative to it. What I often call bad faith suppresses doubt and questions, but healthy faith, it seems to me, faces doubt and questions openly. What he's saying is that we're supposed to keep wrestling with God. Now, I know you all well enough, I think many of you I know well enough to know that for some of you, that is, it's your thoughts. It's your background. It's the way you were raised. It's theological ideas. It's the things you hear people say, and they say them a certain way, and you just think, like, I don't believe like that anymore, and you are contending with God. For you, it's a mental journey right now. It's you wrestling in your head with God. There's others of you that I know that it's your life circumstances. It's like, I want to believe in God, but this happened, and this thing happened, and then I got sick. And this thing happened, and we find ourselves, like the psalmist, crying out, like, God, come to my aid. And what I want to say this morning is, I think this is what we're supposed to be. What often happens in the Christian community, in the pastoral world, I'll tell you just in the pastoral world, is somebody comes into my office, and they tell me, hey, I'm really wrestling with doubts, or I don't even know if I'm a Christian anymore, I'm wrestling with this thing, I'm wrestling with that thing, or I found out this bad news, and I don't know what to do about this situation and that thing. And I think that what's supposed to happen sometimes is I feel this pressure that I'm supposed to give them answers. Like, I'm supposed to say, well, just say this thing, do this prayer, just trust God. You know, like, I'm supposed to throw cliches at people, just trust God, look for joy, try to be thankful for every situation. And there's some truth to those things. But I think what needs to be said in the church more often, what we need to say with each other, and I even did this week. Somebody came into my office with just horrible news. And I looked across my desk at her and her husband, and I said to her, I think what you're supposed to do is this. I don't think you're supposed to try to contain your emotions and feel better and make sure that everybody else around you feels comfortable. I think you're supposed to be really selfish right now, and you need to cry out to God and tell him just exactly how you feel abandoned. And how you feel alone, and how you feel like God is picking on you. I think you just need to say that to God in whatever language you need to use. You just need to use it, because I think that's the character of God, that God is inviting us into that struggle. And so that's what I want for us. That's what I want for me. That's what I want for the church, is to be the people who struggle with God. And we don't give up, we don't stop the struggle, and sometimes it hurts, and sometimes we walk away from these encounters and we're limping because they've been painful and it's been hard. But yet we walk away like Jacob with this new sense of, this is who I am. Unlike Jacob, hopefully we live into it instead of just going back the other way. But this is what we're supposed to be about. Let's pray. God, help us to be people who struggle with you, and who, God, sometimes the night is really, really long, and the way seems really, really dark, and it seems like the sun is never going to rise. And God, I pray that you help us to be the people who keep struggling and keep naming what it is that we're struggling with. And help us to be a community that supports that and encourages that and encourages us to keep going after God, to keep going after you. And I think that you're kind. I think you're like a dad wrestling on the floor with us sometimes, and that you want us to push and you want us to flex our muscles and you want us to give it all our strength. And I think maybe you're doing that because you love us and you're trying to help us grow into more mature forms of faith. I think. And so be with us. Help us to support each other in our struggles. Help us to be a place that's deeply dialogical about the most important things. In your name I pray. Amen.